Welcome back to New Rockstars. I'm Eric Voss. Rick and Morty Season 4 is coming soon, and we are launching our official Rick and Morty after show, Rick-splained. We got a blessing from Dan Harmon himself, and each week I will dive into the hidden, deeper metaphor for which each episode is secretly a cry for help. And to discuss whether or not my hot takes on these episodes are really just postmodern analytical bullshit, I'm inviting special guests from the Rick and Morty staff here to Starburn Studios, where apparently the first two Rick and Morty episodes were written in the office right next door to ours. These staff members are going to reveal some of the stuff that you would otherwise never know about each episode, and they're going to confirm how much of a reach my explanations are. Now, a reminder to subscribe to the Rick and Morty podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll have access to the official Rick and Morty after show. Now, I will be breaking down each of the hidden jokes and animation Easter eggs from each episode in separate breakdowns. Those ain't going anywhere. But in these final days before season four, I'm going to look back at each season in the past and examine one standout episode from that season that best summed up the overall trajectory of that season across Rick and Morty's darkest timeline. For season one, that episode is, without a doubt, Close Rick Counters of the Rick Kind, the episode that introduced the Citadel of Ricks and Evil Morty. So the goal of season one was to introduce us to how Rick and Morty are unique among every animated comedy duo that we've seen. And beneath the jokes lies what I believe is a deeper metaphor that Morty Smith and Rick Sanchez are thinly veiled animated versions of series creators Justin Roiland and Dan Harmon. There's actually been a lot written about the broader parallels between Rick as a character and Dan Harmon himself. I'm not the first one to come up with this. Harmon actually told GQ in 2018 about the intersections of his mental health and his writing. He said, "Self-destruction is a control freak's way of monopolizing their own fortune. It's gonna be the most narcissistic thing to hijack God's cockpit and go, no, I'll decide whether it's a good or a bad day." And when it was pointed out to him that this is essentially Rick's life philosophy, Justin Roiland jumped in and actually confirmed, well, there is a lot of Dan and Rick. And he said that since season two, he started accidentally calling Dan Rick in the writer's room, maybe subconsciously, maybe purposely. And I just love that as early as Close Rick Counters of the Rick Kind, that parallel not only is evident in Rick as a character, but it's also very evident in his relationship with Morty, who by comparison definitely seems like an adaptation of Justin Roiland in a couple ways. Let's actually look at all the evidence presented to us in this episode's three acts. Okay, in act one, Rick is falsely accused of murdering hundreds of Ricks. He's dragged into a trial by the Council of Ricks in the Citadel. Morty marvels at the Citadel's existence. Our Rick hates cooperation and connection. He says,
"The point of being a Rick is being a Rick."
And the Council chastises him, saying,
"Why am I the first Rick you pull in every time a Rick stubs his toe? You have a history of non-cooperation with the Council."
Now, this also, in many ways, applies to Dan Harmon's career as a TV writer. The guy is a genius storyteller. He invented the famous story circle used by screenwriters, and he's been known for dense, complex plots and character arcs from his work on the sitcom Community on NBC, but he also has a bit of a reputation for not working that well with others. Like, he feuded with actors and cast members on Community, he got fired, he famously called Steven Spielberg a moron. On his Harmontown podcast and other places, Harmon has owned up to a lot of his toxic behaviors.
Then I went full steam into creeping on my employee.
The more surprising is the way the partnership between Rick and Morty parallels the partnership between Harmon and Justin. Later in Act 2, after escaping the multiverse, Morty optimistically views the existence of infinite Rick and Morty duos as proof that they're meant to work together.
"You know, Rick, when I first saw all those Ricks and Mortys, I thought, gee, that kind of devalues our bond. But then I realized it just means that our relationship must be pretty special to span over all those different timelines."
"Yeah, it's gotta be that way. You're a camouflage."
"Camouflage? What are you talking about, Rick?"
"Ricks have a very distinctive and traceable brainwave due to our genius. The best way to hide from an enemy's radar is to stand near someone with complementary brainwaves that make ours invisible. See, when a Rick is with a Morty, the genius waves get canceled out by the, Morty waves."
Similarly, there's a bit of opportunism at play with the relationship between Harmon and Roiland. Rick and Morty began after Harmon ended his stormy experience with Community, and Roiland was a younger animator and collaborator from Harmon's Channel 101 short film Community in LA. Roiland gave Harmon an opportunity for a fresh start. As is the case with many TV series, a lesser experienced writer will pitch a show that's clearly in their voice and partner with a more seasoned writer to help with the show running duties and shape the structure of each episode. For Harmon, Roiland was an energetic life force that represented a way for him to make 100 more episodes of great TV.
Rick and Morty forever and forever, 100 years, Rick and Morty, some things.
But this isn't just like one-sided exploitation. For Roiland, Harmon's experience and wisdom gave him a huge opportunity too. And just as Morty's inverse brainwaves don't make him dumb, just optimistic and capable of human connection, the opposite of Rick, so does Roiland's love for escapism balance out some of Harmon's darker themes. And that balance becomes clear in Act 3, that epic final reveal that the evil Rick of this episode is actually being remotely controlled by the eye-patched evil Morty. It proves that the toxic behavior associated with Rick is even more capable of taking over a Morty. And if we map that extended metaphor over the relationship between Harmon and Roiland, it serves as a warning that whatever toxic behavior Harmon hoped would be balanced out by working with his Morty, Roiland is smart enough, ambitious enough to do this all without his Rick. But hey, that's just my Rick-splanation. Is this what people who worked on the show had in mind? Well, we've invited the hilarious writer who wrote this episode, Ryan Ridley, on the show to explain these secrets behind the episode right after this quick message from our sponsors.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey everyone, Eric here. We at New Rockstars are overjoyed to finally be able to launch new exciting shows like Rick-splained. But really, the ones who are most to thank for helping us get this started are our patrons over at our Patreon. If you're looking for a way to help this channel grow and do even more new exciting projects, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/newrockstars. We have a ton of great bonus content, behind the scenes looks, as well as exclusive videos that we're just providing to our patrons to thank them. So if you want to join that inner circle and get the insider look, as well as be part of this channel's ongoing success, again, just check out our link in the description, patreon.com/newrockstars. And we are back. Now joining us to help us break down the deeper meaning of that season one episode, Close Rickcounters of the Rick Kind, is the guy who wrote that episode, Ryan Ridley. Thank you for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Woo. Yes. Hey. Also joining this chat is our good friend and Rick and Morty superfan and possible remotely controlled robot, Sam Basher.
Woo! Thank you.
All right. Well, Ryan, earlier in this episode, we were talking about the parallels between the partnership between Rick and Morty and Dan and Justin, which has kind of come up before in various interviews. But I want to know from you, how much did those parallels come up in the writer's room as you guys were breaking this episode or just sitting around the table? How much have Dan and Justin emulated Rick and Morty just organically?
Well, I'll tell you, I used to think that Justin was Morty, but now I've come to realize that Justin is evil Morty. He is way more diabolical than you'd think, given his goofy persona. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like how much did that dynamic influence the actual, I don't think it was something anyone was even conscious of for a long time. I mean, it seems to make sense because Dan is very much like Rick and the things he says and possibly believes and all that. Justin is more like Mr. Meeseeks than he is Morty. I mean, in the sense of his he's not maybe as emotional or is I guess noble and heroic in the sense as Morty is perceived to be in contrast to Rick. He's more of a kind of just an insane, you know, cartoonish being. So I don't know, but then of course it does seem to be an interesting divide, and then physically they kind of you can kind of see like, oh, there's a shirt that I have that actually I assume this was never official merchandise, but I think Stephen Chun, one of the characters in it, drew Rick and Morty as Dan and Justin. It's like a mashup, and it's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Was there ever a moment where like they accidentally referred to each other as Rick or as Morty just by doing the bit as their dialogue and jokes?
God, no. I mean, that's the funny thing is, yeah, gosh, Dan would do the voice of Rick a lot. That was for sure. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because obviously Justin is the voice, but Dan is the voice, mm-hmm. capital V. I don't remember them ever. I one time Justin referred to Dan as dad. So take that for what it's worth.
What could that analysis.
We talk about Evil Morty.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking about like the backstory and the grander story that you're building over these seasons, let's talk about Evil Morty for a second, because was there a plan from the start about what his trajectory would be? And were you surprised the way fans like started theorizing and how they reacted to that character?
No. I mean, that's, to me, like the exact kind of thing that anyone would want to theorize about. I mean, it's such a mysterious, you know, it's also a huge reveal that there are not only other, I think that was, well, technically the love push in #9 sets up the idea of they go to the parallel universe in the first place, but then opening up into, oh, but actually there's all these other versions, and then that episode revealed not only are there other versions, they might be completely different characters in the sense of like in this version of Morty, he's an evil genius, is one step ahead of Rick even. And that's like exciting in itself and super cool. And you want to know, clearly he has a plan, because that episode ends with his Kaiser Soze moment that he was, you know, right? So like, oh shit, this character is the Moriarty of this show and is capable of so much more, and that they're, you know, clearly there's something bigger going on, right? So it makes perfect sense. People were excited about it in the sense of like, you know, the Meeseeks are funny and they say funny things, but do you really need to see more of that, you know?
I wouldn't mind. Always a bit more.
Mm-hmm. I always pitched, let's do red Meeseeks. What were the, like, the, like, it's like, you know how Superman's kryptonite was, you know, well, this red kryptonite does this and white kryptonite. I was like, let's, like, maybe red Meeseeks do something, or different.
Yeah, what would red Meeseeks do? So instead of, like, wish fulfillment or task fulfillment, it's like they murder someone?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought, like, it'd be cool, like, because Meeseeks weren't really, I mean, unless it was established, I don't remember that they were, like, manufactured by the box. I thought it'd be cool that they, you go to their world and you watch them disappearing. Like, you know, they're being taken from some, their own autonomous world where they have their own, you know, they're doing their own tasks.
Yeah, they're in the middle of dinner making dinner
exactly.
And they get summoned.
And as soon as they come to our world, it is pain and they want that to end immediately.
Yeah. Just so they can go back to playing Fallout.
Much like Superman, Superman comes to our world and he's got superpowers.
Yeah.
You know, they come to our world and they're like, fuck, this hurts and I have to do some of these dishes.
Well, we were talking about, like, you voice the bully character in the pilot. You also voice a lot of the chair and pizza and phone montage in this episode.
Yeah.
And which is one of the most, like, inventive moments of the show. To me, that, like, opened the doors for the narrative possibilities and some of the absurdist, like, escapism that could happen. Mm-hmm. Were there any other ideas that were thrown? Like, there was Greasy Grandma World. There was, like, the butt dimension. Were there, like, other pitches for places you guys could have gone?
I'm sure there were thousands. I'm sure that that's probably what it started. I mean, you know, much like a lot of the ideas for the show, when it comes down to after breaking the story and it's just details, it's like, just write a whole list of ideas, you know? And so there must have been a bunch. But I remember when we landed on that, especially the chase through the different cycling, that was like, it stands out in my mind as like one of the truly most joyous experiences of that season, because it was like, oh my god, this is going to be so fun and amazing and weird, and to like an easy concept just build off of, like, well, if this is true, then that's true, and like there'd be homeless couches or whatever. I can't remember.
What homeless couch, like drinking liquor out of a bus or something.
Yeah, and then they, I think the couch like does like a double take.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's like easy basic comedy, but also ties into the multiverse concept, and you know, it's a microcosm of what I think is what makes the show great, is that it's like, it's absurdly funny, but then dealing with these interesting sci-fi concepts and then where that all intersects with the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd build off that and say, like, the dark humor is definitely a big part of the draw for this show. And in this particular episode, there's one joke that stood out to me while watching it. It's when they arrive to the dome of evil Rick and Morty, and covering the dome are the Mortys being tortured, and there's a line that our Rick says where it's like payday at Neverland Ranch. So that stands out. Would you say that there were any jokes or joke pitches that were like left at the table or were outright rejected when it came to writing this episode?
Because of quality or because of how dark?
Maybe censors.
I'm trying to think if I can ever remember anything that was deemed too intense. Is it, what episode is it where it's the one where they're in the giant land?
And that is the Misi. That's the Ace.
Oh, that's the B story? Yeah. Okay, so and I think, did I write that one? I mean, we all wrote it, but I know I have my name on maybe that episode. So yeah, so they have the encounter with Mr. Jellybean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like, you know, almost a little too, like, okay, guys, like, we get it. You're making a shocking Adult Swim show where you, So I'm thinking if we did that, then something's gonna come to me that was too dark. I can't think of something in that episode. The challenge of that episode was just figuring out the story, because I think that was the story, that was the episode that really started to do what I love to do personally, or what I love the show does, is kind of create little mini movies. You know, like that episode could have been the Rick and Morty movie, mm-hmm. you know, if it was blown out into 90 minutes. It kind of has the structure of an epic journey, much like the Morty Night Run kind of episode. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that episode was more about just the difficulties of just figuring out the structure of that episode. And the Morty Dome was like, I'm trying to think what that was. It was some solution to some, like, it was always about like, well, wait, why wouldn't Rick know this? And how, oh, because there's some, for whatever reason, Morty waves block Rick waves, yeah, right? Yeah. That was the idea. So it was like, it's always stuff like, I can swear, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The FCC,
yeah.
Don't with YouTube. So it was always like the logic issues are more the problems than anything else, because all our sensibilities, I think, were inherently dark. Mm-hmm. So it was rarely going to be like, whoa, guys. I mean, mm-hmm. if you watch anything Justin or Dan made before, there's nothing too dark.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that like what start as logical answers to puzzles become these like interesting theory components. Like the whole idea of Rick and Morty having opposing inverse brainwaves, mm-hmm. like also reflects so much more about their characters and how, because they're opposite ends of a spectrum, that like tells you so much about the dynamic of their relationship and like the dynamic of every Rick and Morty relationship throughout the multiverse.
Yeah, and that makes me now go back organically to your first question, is that is Dan and Justin's relationship, is their brain waves are very opposite. I mean, you know, Justin doesn't need for the story to be so purely logical from a Campbellian story sense that Dan is famous for proselytizing. And, you know, Justin is like, why can't Rick break the fourth wall? Mm-hmm. You know, why can't we just have complete nonsense? And sometimes we'd be like forced into things like, no, we, you know, I remember the finale of that season with the party episode, the monsters that stick people in them or what, outside the party.
Oh, right, right. They just exchange like, them and pass them off to each other.
Justin's like, I just want testicle monsters. Just make it work, guys. Like, great. Now, instead of starting out with a great story idea, we have to make a story work around testicle monsters as the center of the orbit. And so that's, when it works, it's great, and it's perfectly balanced, and sometimes, you know, it's like one of them will hate what the other one's trying to do, but when it all clicks and works together in a synergistic way, it's great.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you for unpacking this episode with us, Ryan. You can stay tuned for everything, all the new projects that Ryan has in the pipeline that we're not allowed to announce yet, but it's very exciting stuff, I'm sure. And thank you to Sam Basher for joining us. You can follow Sam Basher on Twitter and Instagram at mm-hmm. Sam Basher. And now we will be back next episode with a look at the season 2 episode, Autoerotic Assimilation, and what we believe it really means. And Ryan's going to fact check us on that. But another reminder to subscribe to the Rick-Splained podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Once this season 4 begins, this show will turn into our official Rick and Morty after show, and we're gonna have all kinds of exciting guests and inside looks at the episode. And see you next time. Thank you for joining us. Bye bye.